All right. So a lot of these examples that we're going to see are looking at the relationship between the amount and difficulty of exam practice and exam performance. It's something that I worked on for 5 or 6 years. It gives you some pretty cool data. The data are nice because they show you the value of nonlinear relationships and the value of interactions. I'll be honest with you, not every set of data you pull out is going to show you the value of interactions and curvilinear relationships, because an awful lot of behavior is fairly well captured by linear additive effects. So it's nice to have a whole family of analyses that show us cooler things. So we're looking at exam performance in the first graduate research methods data analysis course. We've got psychology graduate students who are doing experimental in the clinical program. So that's a binary variable. We've got the multiple category variable, their future employment intentions, whether that's quantitative research or teaching. We have the number of stats course they had before the current one, and a measure of academic performance motivation. I will tell you that you get this future employment and current motivation, and you start putting it into models, and the world opens up. It does more to tell you about how kids spend their time and what they are and are not successful at than any other couple of variables I know. One of the things we're going to need is the descriptive statistics, because for all of the quantitative variables, we're going to want means and standard deviations. For the criterion variable, we're going to want it so that we can tell the plotting program what to do. For the quantitative predictors, we're going to be interested in that so that we know for centering values and also for plotting. In the plotting program, you're going to need to give it the mean and the standard deviation for any continuous variable that you want it to plot. So now we start getting our data ready for analysis. And just like in this on-the-fly example, there's some to do. So the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to dummy code practice. I wanted to set it up so that practice that was the same difficulty as the exam would be the comparison group, so same is set to zero. Those people who got easier practices got a one. The reason for comparing same to easier is that at the time there was a notion going around with multiple publications that the best way to get somebody ready for something is to coddle them. That's not the way they characterized it, but when you see in the data, you'll see that that shitty characterization is fairly honest. The clinical group had tended to have more in it, and so I set that up as the comparison group for the program dummy code. No particular reason, just very often the larger group gets set up as the comparison group, because that way the rest of the model is primarily about them, and you can ask then how the model changes if you shift to the less common group. We're going to set up teaching as the comparison group for the multiple group variable. The first one is going to compare quant with teaching. The second one is going to compare research with teaching. Yes?
This may be because I missed something, but I always have a problem with this. So in the first one, research is also zero.
Yes.
And so why is it necessarily compare quant with teaching?
That variable isn't. You're right. Yeah, that dummy code is comparing this to the average of these two. This is comparing it to this to the average of these two. When you put them in together, this is comparing these two holding this at zero, which means not including the other group. So when you put these in together, the collinearity between them creates the interpretation that you've been told. But you're absolutely right. One at a time doesn't freaking make sense. And it gets worse when you put interaction terms in. Because when you take a dummy code times a quantitative variable to build your interaction term, one whole group gets zeros, and the other whole group has the same value as their continuous variable. And it doesn't look like it makes any sense, and it doesn't bivariately. But it creates a collinearity pattern that gives us back what we're looking for, which is a multiple regression model. A contribution of a variable to a multiple regression model taken the collinearity into account? Great question. And one of those questions sort of reappears, usually between midnight and 2 o'clock. It's like, wait, how the hell does this work? We're going to mean center practice. We're going to mean center prior, and we're going to mean center motivation. Two reasons for mean centering. Now, the other regression weights are about what's going on with people who are average on these things instead of people who have zero on these things. The motivation score doesn't even go down to zero. I think the smallest score you can get is not zero. And so why look for the performance of people at a value that doesn't exist? Also, mean centering, especially when you're going to go ahead and build your quadratic terms, reduces the collinearity to the collinearity between the constructs instead of the collinearity between the measures. So we've got our mean-centered variables that are going to carry our linear relationships, and we've got our mean-centered and squared variables that are going to carry our quadratic relationships. So we start out with 5 variables, and we end up with, 9 terms. 2 for the multiple group coding, 3 more we pick up for the quadratic. So we start out, and this is a really big happy number. When you're trying to understand exam performance, getting almost 2/3 of the variance is lovely. It's not common. It's wildly significant, even on not a huge sample. And so we got all of this. This tells us that there is a significant difference between quant and teaching. The higher coded group has a better performance by almost 10. So on a quant course, people who are expecting to go on to a quant career do about 10 points better than people who are planning to go on to a teaching career. Now, technically, that's just for the people with same practice and the average on everything. But again, since there's no interaction terms, that's really telling us the expected value for everybody in any combination of other things.
Wait.
Yeah. Because it's a main effect model.
So it's only looking at main effect.
Yeah. Because it's a main effect model, we don't have any conditionality. Because that's the kind of model we're doing right now. Remember, all of the rest of this course is about being able to put any kind of interaction in and deal with it. So I'm delighted that you look at this and say, why the hell would we do this? This means you've bought into the importance of conditional statements.
Oh,
models. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I wish you had M&Ms.
I wish you did too.
This shows that when you take everything else into account, there's no difference between the people who expect a research and a teaching career. There is a numerical difference, but it's not big enough to be statistically significant. We don't have great power here, but you know, this is a p-value. And this p-value tells us that if we decide there's a difference between research and teaching career people, then we got a 23% chance that that's a type 1 error. If we had 1,400 people instead of 140, we would expect to get about the same value, and it would be significant. Because the same size effect is more believable from a bigger sample. Right? Go all the way back to the first example. If you ask 3 of your closest friends whether you should go out on a date with this person, 2 out of 3 isn't all that convincing. You ask 300 of your closest friends and 200 of them say yes, 200 out of 300 is the same 2/3. But it's a lot more convincing than 2 out of 3. Same thing here. Bigger sample size, same effect size, is more convincingly not zero. We see that there is a significant practice difficulty effect. Notice that it's zero. That means that the higher coded group, which is easier, did poorer than the lower coded group, which is same. We can see that we've done everything we can. Oh, I'm sorry. We see that there's no difference, I mean, really sort of strongly no difference, between the experimental and the clinical folks. If we look at the practice effect, we see that there is no linear, but there is a quadratic practice effect. There's a slight but nowhere near significant negative linear relationship. And there is a negative quadratic, which means as you move from less practice to more practice, the slope becomes less positive. So we've got something that starts out darn near flat and is flat on average, but it's something like that. It goes from positive to flat to negative. And how do I know where to put this? Because technically it is the slope for the mean centered value. Yeah. Yeah, it's all curve, no slope. That's as close to a true quadratic, inverted U-shaped quadratic as you're going to get. One end higher than the other. If this were significantly negative, the whole thing would tilt clockwise.
Is there any value in drawing pictures showing both linear and curve?
Well, you do when you draw the whole picture. I'm just showing you that I know I'm starting from, I'm going to add a quadratic to a flat linear, as opposed to adding that quadratic to a positive or a negative. Because this just tells me about the quadratic part added to this linear. The only way you know how much to tilt the thing is the amount of linear. This is just the amount of curve. That's why we centered this and then squared that, is to separate those two. And the light goes on. Yeah.
You centered it at a different value.
Uh-huh. Keep going. Yeah, for example, if we'd centered it out here, then we're going to get, that linear term is going to be the tangential slope there, and we would get a significant negative. And if we bring it all the way out here, then we might get a significant positive. We got to remember that a quadratic term is a kind of interaction. It's a conditionalizing. What's the linear part? Just here, not everywhere. And that gets confused a lot because people sometimes are taught that this is the general linear slope. It's not. It's the tangential linear slope at whatever zero means based on how we centered. So, you nailed it.
So how do we
are going to tend to focus on specific values. The regions thing gets a little squirrely depending upon which package you're using, how they calculate a couple of those covariance matrices and things like that. So what we're going to focus on instead is if you want to know what's going on in a particular place, how to code and center to ask that particular question.
Okay.
And if you want to ask several of them, you start pulling it off in pieces. It's what SAS does in the slice procedure. Okay, which you can do in some situations in SPSS and GLM. And the rest of the time, what I want you to know how to do is take over and compute and have exactly what you want. The regions of significance thing gets complicated quickly, and there's not just one true way. Kind of a bummer. Yes?
If we're looking at a normal distribution, the reason we pick the mean is because it probably contains
Yeah, it's telling us about the center of the group, the most common thing.
So on the edges over there, that might be some sort of an outlier. If you wanted to look at where your outliers were, you'd pick some extreme values.
Yeah. But the only thing that's going to change in this whole model is the linear parts. Because that curve's set. Because remember, the curve is the highest order term. The highest order term doesn't care how you've defined things. Yeah, it's just where we're looking. At what tangential slope? It's you jumping right in. Don't try and bully her on the playground. All right. Prior stats. Notting. And we gave it a pretty good go, too. Because looking not just at linear but at quadratic, there are not a lot of effects out there that don't have a linear, don't have a quadratic, but have a higher order effect. And so if you don't have linear or quadratic, for the most part, you need a good reason to go looking for something spiffier. When we look at motivation, we can see that we have both. This means that on average, we expect that to go up, except we got that quadratic term in. So it's not talking about on average. It's talking about at the average amount of motivation, what does an increase in motivation do for us? And since this sucker is positive, so we've got a slope of 0.153, and we've got a positive, it's not big, well, how big is the beta? So we got something like, let's say something like this. Slope becomes more positive as it goes up. If we start out here, for every increase in motivation, we expect performance to go up by 0.153. But we also know that if we're out here, because of the shape of that curve, that you're going to get a bigger practice effect if you start at a higher amount of practice. You're going to get a smaller practice effect if you start out at a lesser amount of practice. That's the conditionality, the interaction-like quality of that quadratic term. It depends. Another thing I want to point out is that those quadratic term raw regression weights are often really itty-bitty tiny. Don't be put off by that. I mean, that's way bigger than that. That's only twice as big. Okay? And remember what's going on. To get this term, we are squaring another variable. And the way that you estimate the standard deviation of a product is it's the product of the standard deviation of the two variables. Squaring is a kind of product. And so this squared term has a much bigger standard deviation than this linear term. And because it has a much bigger standard deviation, it's going to tend to have a lower regression weight. Right? Because that regression weight, in addition to capturing the relationship between the variables, has to be part of scaling the predictors to match the criterion. And so this predictor has a much bigger standard deviation than that one, and so it's going to get scaled down more. And that's why it's really nice to have the beta weights. And that's why in SPSS it's really nice to be able to do the regression, because you don't get the beta weights out of the GLM. Now you can calculate them, but it's still sort of a pain in the ass. All right, so there's our model. There's our discussion of what each thing means, remembering that the linear terms are conditional because of how we centered. The grouping variables are not conditional because they're not involved in an interaction. The quadratic terms are not conditional because they're not involved in an interaction. And here I've articulated all of that for you. So now, what we can do is we can go into this and we can pluck out any part of the model and display it. So especially for quadratic terms, the verbal description can be augmented by showing a plot of the model. For example, if we wanted to show the shape of the relationship between practice and performance, controlling for the other variables, we use the plotting program. And all we do is we plug in the terms that we care about. We have to know what the other terms are set to so we know who we've plotted. So when we plug this in and we get this plot, this certainly looks like a relationship with a non-significant negative relationship. Notice the right side of the plot is only slightly lower than the left, and a strong inverted U shape. However, the range of the performance scores seems odd. That's a pretty narrow range from, you know, about 67 to about 71. I mean, that's a nice picture, but then you look at the y-axis and you think, well, we're not, is that really the range? Because we come up here and we see two other things that makes us wonder how much information we've really gotten. We understand that we got 62% of the variance, and this thing has a standard deviation of 8. So two-thirds of the scores are between 64 and 80, but only two-thirds, and that's all we've really got here. So it's not awful, but there's more to the story. Why? Remember that this specific linear and quadratic relationship between practice and performance, controlling for the other variables in the model, specifically this is the shape of the relationship for those intending to teach who practice with similar difficulty problems that were in the clinical program, had the sample average motivation and the sample average of prior stats courses. We know that some of those other variables had effects. So this plot, while sort of a plot on average, is missing some of the variation. And so we can plot more than one variable at a time. The other primary variable in the study was the difficulty of the practice. So we change what part of the plotting Excel program we use. And now we're going to plug in the elements from practice and group difference. And when we do that, this is the line we already got. If you look at it carefully, this is the line we already got because that other line was for the similar difficulty coded 0. So we didn't get, and this is a common mistake that I don't want you to make, we didn't get this line. We got that one before. Now we're saying, you know what? Let's expand the range of criteria values that we're getting by grabbing the other group that performed more poorly. Now we've got a bigger range of variables account of values accounted for because we don't just have that group and we never had the average. Now we've got these two groups. Watch out for people that are giving you a really cool model that's over a really small range of the criterion variable. They're hiding something from you. And watch out when people tell you that they're telling you about the group on average, because the only way that I can get, I can do it. You'll see. You already know this one. You just don't know it. If I wanted that group for average instead of for same, then I would just go back and recode the same difficulty using effects coding. I make 1.5 and I make the other one negative 0.5. The average is 0 and that's who I get the line for. Is that cooler than shit or what? You can have anything you want. And that's why I like this process more than the significance range. Is you go looking for specific things. You want the average across everybody, you go recenter things, recode things. So now the average is not one group or the other. I'm sorry, the line is not for one or the other, it's for 0, which is now the average. So you can have it for one group, flip the code, have it for the other group. Or if you want the average, change the code to effects coding. And so what you could do is you can have the blue line with easy coded 0. Same coded 0. You can have the red line with easy coded 0. Or you can use effects coding and get the average. You can have whatever you want. Which if you were initially trained on, some of the bullshit I was initially trained on is glorious. That's why I get so excited about it. I can build that model and I can show you, here's who you care about. I can show somebody else in the room, here's who you care about. That sort of specificity is exciting because that moves this from being math to being descriptions of behavior, which is what we're supposed to care about. So another thing I wanted to look at is I wanted to look at the relationship between we found a fairly large career intention effect. So we're going to look now at practice and career intention. We're going to use the 3 by Q tab and we're going to put in the slope and the curve and the group difference, the two dummy codes, and we just leave the interaction term set to zero. Model doesn't care, the plotting function doesn't care if those are an assigned zero or a discovered zero. It still draws us parallel lines. And now notice we've got a much wider range because those people in the quantitative group did really better than the others. I mean, these other lines are down here. And so now we've got that picture that we can look at. And there's nothing in this picture that wasn't in the description of the regression weights. But most people will find this easier to look at and be more compelling. Yeah. More compelling than just the words. You in particular.
I know. I wonder if there was another way.
No, the pictures are the best thing you have. The thing that's complicated about the pictures is you can't get the whole model into one picture. You're talking about, you know, five predictors and nine lines, and you got to walk people through it. But each thing that you're trying to articulate, you throw a picture in there, and you can articulate that a little more easily. But still, I mean, you took on a five-predictor model. It ain't going to be easy. But this can make it easier. Think of it as a quadratic function. So here's one more where we look at motivation and task performance. So we have motivation and whether things were easier or simpler. And I'll tell you that this gets more interesting later when you start allowing interaction terms and putting some other variables in. But, you know, starting out with the main effects regression model, which is all that most people ever use, this shows that there's this motivation effect. Now remember, we put in the linear, and we're cool. We put in the quadratic. But remember, with just the linear in, it has to be a straight line. With just a quadratic in, it has to be a smooth curve. And the consequence of that smooth curve is that this sucker starts to come back up. We're plotting the model, not the data. And so when we look at this, it looks like people with lower motivation did a little bit better than... This is a natural, necessary consequence of putting in just a linear and a quadratic. If you really mattered, if it mattered to you and wanted to clean this up, you would try putting in the cubic term. Because that cubic term allows you to have an inflection point there and another inflection point there that allows this to flatten out, or you might even find out that it has a dip. So the two times that I really like, go ahead and stuff it in that cubic to clean up a quadratic, rather than because I think there's a cubic, is if you get this hook. Maybe that hook's real, maybe that hook is imposed by the quadratic-only model. And the other thing is, if you get to values either on the high or low end, that cannot be. So you're predicting GPA and you get 4.2 GPA out here. Put another curve in that sucker and see if it doesn't clean it up. So once again, you're able to look at a picture, you say, all right. Now remember, this picture has a really huge assumption in it. And that is that these two groups really do have the same slope and have the same slope, same curve, and really differ by the same amount at any level of motivation. Yes. Okay, and we'll take that on each of the next several meetings as we look at another kind of interaction model. And we're going to come back and be able to drop that interaction term in on top of this model and see if when we plot this, it really looks like this. So let's see at what joy and bliss I have for you today.